Good morning from New York, and welcome to the NIAC Talks podcast spotlight on international arbitration in Latin America. My name is Rekha Rangachari, and I'm NIAC's executive director. We're delighted to offer different styles of programs during this period of shelter in place where we can discuss topics in addition to COVID-19 and its effects. We're fortunate, again, to have many representatives from global jurisdictions on the line, and so my thanks to each of you. Today, we embark on the second episode of the three-part podcast series. If you're joining us for the first time, in each session, we'll take a sampling of jurisdictions to understand how systems within Latin America and the rule of law evolve in parallel with an interconnected set of political, economic, and cultural challenges. Our topics cover broadly the state of international arbitration within these jurisdictions and the synergistic elements that lead to change, including political, legal, and commercial developments and their interplay with international order. In so doing, we'll highlight the distinctiveness of the Latin American experience, which lends itself to great intra-regional diversity. And we'll demonstrate how dispute involvement is not uniform across the region. These are political economies of variation within Latin America. As you can appreciate, we'll focus on the big picture in the next 45 minutes as we discuss change to the system in this episode. We look to Peru, Bolivia, and Chile. Each jurisdiction has demonstrated relevance within international arbitration by adapting practices, change in administration affecting change in policy, and keeping each on the main stage from power seats of Lima, La Paz, and Santiago. We offer three main considerations for each jurisdiction. First, challenges and opportunities in times of political change. Second, the effects of this change on investment arbitration. And third, the effects of this change on commercial arbitration. I'm joined by two leaders in international arbitration known to many of you who also hail from NIAC founding firms. Noyana Marigo is a partner at Freshfields Brockhaus Derringer. She is chair of its U.S. International Arbitration Group and co-chair of its Latin America practice. And Anibal Sabater, he is partner at Chaffetz Lindsay and member of NIAC's Board of Directors. Thanks to each of them for joining again. Three administrative items to delegates. First, the session is being recorded. Second, as we progress through these topics, please submit your questions within the Q&A portal in Zoom. And third, in the materials previously circulated by email, you will find both the CLE articles and CLE affirmation. We'll introduce the CLE course code later in the program, so do stay tuned. Please complete the affirmation to receive credit and send it to Bill Kaczmarek, who is included in copy. Now, on to the substantive program. We turn first to Peru, a country where voting is compulsory by law. And as you can imagine, this increases the practice of spoiled and blank ballots, split votes, that we saw earlier this year, in parallel with curiosities of Congress's dissolution. And so, Anibal, can you lead us through the political developments in Peru? Who's in charge? Feel free to add color to the discussion with items that have hit recent headlines: corruption, bribery, Lava Jato, and Odebrecht.
Well, thank you very much, Rekha, and thank you very much, Noyana. Delighted to be here with you and, of course, with our audience. Thanks, everyone, for joining. Peru is a singular country in which politics, the economy, and arbitration intersect heavily. The reality is there has been political instability in Peru for the last 20 years since the fall of President Fujimori. All presidents, President Fujimori himself, and all presidents after him have been investigated for corruption and abuse of power. One committed suicide a couple of years ago following a criminal investigation against him. Several have been sentenced. Former President Alejandro Toledo was recently arrested in California and is awaiting extradition from the US to Peru on corruption charges. Incumbent President Martin Vizcarra himself remains highly controversial. He called a parliamentary election in January 2020. And as Rekha was saying, voting was mandatory, yet 20% of the votes were invalid or blank. And no party obtained more than 11% of the ballots. So it's a very fractious and disengaged electorate. Interestingly, however, throughout most of these years of political turmoil, the economy continued to expand significantly. So you had this very remarkable dynamic of a fairly healthy economy and a pretty much broken down political system. That was until in 2014 came the Odebrecht scandal, which made things much more complicated. I'm sure all of you are familiar with it. Odebrecht is a large construction company based out of Brazil, but doing businesses really worldwide and especially across the Americas. And they were found to have paid bribes in many jurisdictions, including Peru. There was a heavy reaction in Peru and pretty much almost anywhere where bribes were found to have been paid. But in Peru, the reaction was particularly significant. It really brought down politicians. It led to the arraignment of former presidents. It was a very significant investigation. And the good news is that the system, the Peruvian legal system, really worked to a degree in the wake of the Odebrecht slash Lavallato scandal. Odebrecht was found to pay bribes in the wake of the so-called Lavallato scandal in Brazil. So the rule of law started to function properly. It was applied in Peru. There was a healthy reaction against abuses and bribes. And there was surely a legitimate attempt to eliminate corruption in ways probably you haven't seen in other countries, such as Mexico, where bribes have historically enjoyed wide circulation. But at the same time, investigating magistrates and state prosecutors really ended up running the country, ended up running Peru in a way reminiscent of what happened in Italy or in Spain in the 1990s. Politicians in Peru are now routinely arrested on corruption and illegal campaigning charges, and there's very little elaboration or legal discussion on the charges. Indictments are often perfunctory, and maybe the charges themselves are founded, but they're not clearly explained, and there's a pervading air of uncertainty as to who may be jailed next. So at this point, the political and by now judicial crisis has really started to have a paralyzing effect on the economy, which is aggravated, of course, by the arrival of COVID-19. Big projects are cancelled. Government officials are afraid to award large contracts or make significant economic decisions because they are afraid they are going to be second-guessed. And generally, businesses doubt the government's ability to pull through, to remain in office, not be prosecuted, be effective at running the country. Now, arbitration, of course, has also been affected. This is very interesting because in Peru, the use of arbitration, especially domestic arbitration, is pervasive. Tax and administrative disputes must be arbitrated by law. This means that every year, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of arbitrations against the state. And there are two or three scores of arbitrators whose full-time job is to arbitrate disputes involving the government. The problem is that Odebrecht and other bribing agents are suspect of having unlawfully obtained favorable awards from arbitrators in local cases. So I think Noyana will touch on this, but this has unfolded into a situation in which the legitimacy of domestic arbitration in Peru is contested. Arbitrators have been arrested, and the presumption of immunity probably hasn't been observed. In January 2020, all this translated into a protectionist reform to the Domestic Arbitration Act, really limiting the use of domestic arbitration against the government. And as crises usually go, this one is also extending and thus moving from having purely an impact on domestic arbitration to really affecting international arbitrations with a Peruvian nexus. as Noyana will also explain soon. So when you couple this fraught political and legal context with COVID-19, the reality is you have an extremely unexpected situation where claims, investment claims are on the one hand likely to grow in the near future, but on the other hand, you're likely to see some resistance to the acceptance of arbitration, especially in the local Peruvian community. Examples of new claims. Well, I think this has been in the news repeatedly, but Peru recently suspended payment of tolls in some highways. That's a measure that has been followed by complaints from concession holders and threats of investment cases against the government. More measures are likely to give rise to similar grievances. So undoubtedly, just to bring it to a quick conclusion, I think the next chapter involving arbitration in Peru and related to Peru is going to be fascinating. So back to you, Rekha.
So moving then to Noyana, in the face of fraud, corruption, and bribery, as Anibal has spoken about, can you tell us about the legal developments in Peru, amendments to the law, and also, as it pertains, and Anibal hinted to, the Odebrecht scandal and arbitrator detention? Noyana, the line is yours.
So I just wanted to say that it was a pleasure to share this panel again with the two of you, and also wanted to thank everyone for joining the Spotlight podcast. So Peru, very interesting developments in the field of arbitration, and I would say dangerous developments, as I think Anibal hinted a little bit. So just as a way of context for everyone, in 2008, Peru enacted the, at the time, new arbitration law, which followed very closely the ancestral model law. And with that, it actually acquired model legislation. There was also a state procurement and contracting legislation, which provided for mandatory, and this is quite unusual, that is a mandatory arbitration for disputes in state contracts. And that was a great way to promote arbitration in Peru. And I'm sure everyone here who has been following the developments in arbitration in Latin America have heard about the community in Peru. The arbitration community has been extremely active with conferences, promoting Lima as a seat of arbitration, educating the courts. So a huge effort was done. And it was starting to create some results. Actually, there had been already a huge increase in arbitrations in Peru in the last decades, including in contract with the state, of course, and in the banking and insurance and construction sectors. So everyone was going relatively well until some of the developments of the Odebrecht scandal not only touched the political branches of the state, but also the arbitration sector. So in November 2019, last year, there was a judge, which is in a preparatory investigation court, that ordered the pre-trial or the preventative detention of 14 arbitrators for 18 months. One of these 14 arbitrators was Fernando Cantuarez Salaverry. I'm sure many of you have heard of him. He sat in ICSID arbitrations and he was very well known in the international community. So this created a huge outrage in the arbitration community, and we'll see what the reactions were. But just to give you a quick update on what the accusations were. So the argument of the court was that these arbitrators had accepted bribes in relation to a series of disputes between Odebrecht and the state, and basically that the arbitrations were already settled in advance for an amount of money and was just a covering. In the case of Cantuarias, the allegations were in particular that the tribunal, and this was an ad hoc proceeding, had fixed the fees for the tribunal in a way that were resulted higher than those published by the Lima Chamber of Commerce rules, and also that they had been increased over time during the proceedings. This is very worrying because, as many of you know, if we have an ad hoc arbitration, it means that the Lima Chamber of Commerce rules were not applicable. So that's the first wrong criteria to start looking at whether the fees were fixed in the right way or not. But the court also considered that even fixing the fees in accordance with the amount in dispute was suspicious, because the fees had to be fixed in accordance with the amount awarded. And again, we all know that most of the rules, and particularly the very well-known rules of the ICC, established that the fees of the arbitral tribunal are fixed in accordance with the amount in dispute. And there are very good reasons for that. One is that you don't want to encourage the arbitral tribunal to increase damages in order to increase the fees, and also what happens in the case that the case is dismissed. So you want to detach the interest of the members of the tribunal to the result of the case, of course. So this shows very little understanding on how arbitration works, and taking this to the arena of criminal proceedings is very dangerous, of course. Since then, there were many letters sent to the Minister of Justice, particularly from many institutions, including the ICC, showing concern, and the detention has been revoked. End of last year, the arbitrators were allowed to remain under investigation, but from home, after paying $30,000 in bond, and they are they're barred from leaving the country, and they have to report to the courts every 30 days. So two big consequences from these developments. One is a huge red flag for arbitrators sitting in Peru. I'm not going to be wrong if I say that any arbitrator today will think 10 times before accepting an appointment in a case sitting in Peru. And even if you manage not to have the hearings in Peru, of course, if you end up entangled in a criminal procedure, it can ruin your career. So this level of intervention by the courts in arbitrations, but also the lack of understanding on how procedures work, is very worrying. It can be, and we can argue that this is only because of the Odebrecht context, and it's not going to happen in the future, but a big question mark, I think, will remain for a couple of years. So this basically is, we're going back many years in all of the developments that the community had, that all of the developments that they have accomplished in the last couple of years, promoting Lima as a seat for arbitration. And the other reason, the amendment that we saw, is that now there's a new law for the state procurement and contracting law, which basically is forbidding ad hoc arbitrations for the state. And not only are these arbitrations are going to be institutional, which wouldn't be that much of an issue, but there's going to be a special institution that would deal with these arbitrations, and apparently the requirements to be an arbitrator in that institution are very limited, which means that it might be a very small pool of people who will be deciding these cases. There's also a big limitation for courts issuing provisional measures in support for arbitration. The requiring party will have to have a bond, to post a bond, and that might limit the possibility of many parties who might not have the enough credit to obtain provisional measures. So as a way of conclusion, I think that we've seen, as a consequence of the Odebrecht scandal, it has really affected Lima as a seat of arbitration, and also what we're going to see in terms of developments of practices in the future for international and domestic arbitration in Peru.
Thank you, Noyana. As Anibal and Noyana have indicated, there is an air of uncertainty in Peru. There's been damage to people's faith in their institutions and to the safety of arbitrators seated in Peru. And so time will tell overall how Lima stands as a seat. We next turn to Bolivia, a country with disputed elections and civil protest, another divided electorate warranting change to the system. And so to Noyana, I pose, what are the political developments in country and what is their impact on investment arbitration?
Yeah, thank you. In Bolivia, I think we have seen a roller coaster of developments and literally a roller coaster on fire. As many of you might remember, Evo Morales was elected in 2005 and served during three government periods. And this became the longest serving president in Bolivia's history. And it has been a huge development for two reasons. One, because prior to Evo Morales, many of the presidents, due to the political instability of the country, were not able even to finish their terms. But also the way that Evo Morales was able to remain in power for such a long time. The first step that he did was when he had to be reelected for the first, was the end of his first mandate. He decided to reform the constitutions so that it could be reelected one more time. And in 2008, there was a reform in the constitution. And in 2009, on the basis of that new regime, Evo Morales ended up winning the election with 64% of the popular vote. He was very popular at the time. The economy had improved. There was a huge crisis when Evo Morales came to power, and already within 4 or 5 years of his government, the economy had stabilized. He had taken measures to recover some of the stakes in some of the oil and other public companies, and the economy was working much better. So when it came to the last year of his second mandate, and although the Bolivian constitution, the new one, only provided for two mandates, he decided to argue that in reality, his first mandate didn't count because the constitution of 2008 had refounded the state. So he only had one mandate completed under the new constitution and under the new country. So it went to the electoral tribunal, the Tribunal Supremo Electoral, who sided with Evo Morales, and Evo Morales was able to win elections again in 2014 and again with over 60% of the votes. The economy continued to improve, was growing year after year, a lot of new developments in the infrastructure, improvements in social issues. And in 2009, and when there was no other option under the constitution to really have a new mandate, Evo, I think counting on the wide popular support that he still had at the time, called for a referendum in 2016 to try to get approval for a new mandate in the 2019 election. However, he lost. That referendum said no. And Evo Morales resorted to basically the Constitutional Tribunal, saying that forbidding his candidacy for the fourth term would be a violation of his political rights, and that was a violation of the Inter-American Human Rights Convention. The tribunal accepted the arguments of Evo Morales and allowed him to run one more time. And this was the beginning of the disaster. Elections were held in October last year. I'm sure many of you remember because we've seen all of the violent scenes on TV. On the election day, Evo Morales was leading the election and only and had around 84% of the votes, but he didn't have enough votes not to go for ballotage. And when they were still counting the votes, suddenly the live transmission of the counting and the reporting of the votes at 7:40 p.m. was disconnected. Evo Morales claim victory. And the next day when they published the results, there was more than 10% difference, so that Evo Morales didn't need to go to ballotage. And that created a huge reaction from the opposition, which went to the Organization of American States that was overseeing the election and requested the results of the audit that the organization was conducting. The audit said that there were some irregularities. Then people went to the streets, a lot of riots, a lot of violence, and Evo Morales took the decision to call for a new election and basically dismiss all of the members of the electoral tribunal that didn't have any support any longer. And as you know, that was not enough, and Evo Morales ended up being ousted and had to be accepted under political asylum in Mexico, and now he's currently in Argentina. There had been a huge discussion whether this was a coup d'etat or it was a legitimate ousting, particularly because it was the armed forces who decided that he had to leave after they withdrew the support for his government. Today we have a new government, it's a transition government, and this is the part where we completely change gears. The new government, because the four first ranks of the government of Evo Morales all resigned, so the position of president went to Jeanine Añez, who was the second vice president of the Bolivian Senate, and was part of the opposition. The immediate steps or political steps of President Añez was just to show that there was a political, actually drastic political shift from the government of Evo Morales. First thing that she did was to withdraw from the ALBA and join the Lima Group. The Lima Group is composed by Colombia and Chile, and also provided support for Juan Guaido's claims to the presidency of Venezuela, which is a 180-degree change from what Evo Morales was doing before. And now she has announced that she's going to run for president. The elections had to take place now in May, but they were, of course, rescheduled probably for later this year, given the COVID-19. So what we see today in Bolivia is a huge uncertainty in what is going to happen in the future. We came from a very long period of government of Evo Morales, a very stable political arena and a very stable economic indicators, but now we don't know what the future will show for Bolivia. The reality is 30% of the votes still seem to be in support of the MAS, which is the Evo Morales party, although they will need some alliances to create power in the next elections. And very briefly on what had been the impact on arbitration, and particularly I'm going to just focus on investment arbitration. Of course, during the government of Evo Morales, there has been a huge push against investment arbitration. Bolivia withdrew from all of its BITs, withdrew from the ICSID convention, instituted a new constitution in 2009 where it was forbidden to have foreign investors going to international arbitration for any disputes with the state. And today, actually, there is no framework for international protection for foreign investments. The only thing that remains are the sunset clauses for the existing investments on the basis of the BITs that had been just terminated. But for the future, there is no protection. So far, this government hasn't shown, and maybe because it's transitory, any signs of what they are counting to do. And I think the big answer will be after the coronavirus attacked the economy, of course, Bolivia might need to go back, no matter what government comes to place, might need to go back to the international markets for financing. And that will determine maybe a need to start renewing the investment protections in order to encourage investment and financing for Bolivia. But I think we will have to watch this space and maybe have another podcast in a year to see how things are going there.
Thanks so much, Diana, and for shaping us and our foundation in both the politics and investment law for Bolivia. And so to Anibal, can you describe the new arbitration law and any key takeaways for our listeners?
Sure. Thank you, Enrica, and thank you, Noyana, for the overview. It's not exactly a new arbitration act, but it's, however, a new arbitration climate in Bolivia, all very interesting, as Noyana was suggesting. The political situation is very fluid, and this is, of course, affecting both the economy in general and the legal system in general, and also arbitration in particular. Now, what do you take into account if you have a commercial arbitration somehow involving Bolivia? Well, if the citizens in Bolivia, the short answer is beware. There's arbitration law 708 from 2015, dating back to President Morales's days, which reverses the previous one. The previous law really followed the ancestral model law and facilitated arbitration. Arbitration law 708 from 2015 looks at arbitration with skepticism, heavily codifies the arbitration process, and if you're operating under it, you might be in for a somewhat unexpected ride with court interventions, restrictive interpretations of arbitral consent, sudden carve-outs, because there are some issues which cannot be submitted to arbitration, etc. So certainly get local counsel, get experienced local counsel if you find yourself in a case seated in Bolivia or governed by its arbitration law. Now, how about commercial arbitrations not seated in Bolivia, but still somehow having a Bolivian nexus? Well, the economic activity of multinationals in Bolivia has decreased in recent times following the anti-foreign investment policies of President Morales that Noyana was alluding to. But there are still projects, such as construction projects, large pipelines that need supplies, or ongoing gas exploration and production activities. And these will certainly yield disputes. And the number of significant projects and consequently disputes will likely grow if, as Noyana was describing, administrations friendlier to foreign investment somehow manage to remain in power for the mid and long term, which is not entirely clear now, they will. And as is the case with countries that have in the past, even if not recently, received a fair amount of foreign investment, in Bolivia you have a very qualified domestic bar, used to dealing with foreign corporations and quite capable of providing advice on complex transnational issues. So you might get help on that end. Also, let's not forget that despite its recent political volatility, Bolivia has tended to honor adverse arbitral awards or at least settle on award payment terms. So the country has really made an effort not to disappear from the international economic community the way, say, Cuba or Venezuela have. Bolivia needs to borrow money and remain a debtor in good standing, as Noyana was also saying. And so its hostility to arbitration, while significant during the last few years, is not unfair. And both commercial and investment arbitrations involving the country will surely continue to be conducted. Yet, of course, the country is far from becoming a major international arbitration hub. To do so, not only would it need changes to its arbitration act, but also to its overall economic outlook, political climate, and judiciary. So it's a long-term proposition for Bolivia to be a center of arbitration the way Santiago de Chile, for instance, or Bogota or Panama City have been in recent times. So that's it in a nutshell. Back to you.
Thanks, Anibal. In recap, Bolivia may need to go back to the international market, providing the right moment to reevaluate investment protections. Time will tell whether and how the country stabilizes its politics, invigorates its economy, and increases export. Last but not least, we turn to Chile, a country that withstood the 17-year rule of Pinochet with a constitution from that era. Is it political stability or political rigidity? It depends on how one looks at it. Corruption and congressional gridlock have stirred distrust of politicians and parties in recent times. But here again, time will tell how Chile builds towards its presidential election next year. And so to Aníbal, can you take us through the political developments in Chile?
Sure. Thank you, Reka. Chile is, in a way, the most unexpected addition to this list of countries undergoing change. For the last couple of decades, Chile has been hailed, and rightly so, as very stable politically and as a very safe seat to arbitrate your disputes. There have been significant and, frankly, unexpected developments lately.
Argentina myself and has always been seen as a good student of Latin America, and we used in Argentina always to compare ourselves, why are they doing so well and we cannot create the same stability in our economy at least. All that unfortunately somehow...
Sorry. So I think I'm back. I must have lost the internet connection for a few minutes. My apologies.
So Aníbal, why don't we'll switch back then. Noyana, thank you for jumping in. And thanks to all of our delegates for standing by. So Aníbal, if you want to go ahead and set that political trajectory that can then move us into Noyana's dialogue on what happens thereafter in investment law.
Sure, and my apologies to everyone. I'm sure that when providing the recorded session today, we will be able to easily clean this up. But my apologies for the distraction, everyone. So I was saying that in late 2019 and 2020, there was serious social unrest, and ultimately the president of Chile, Mr. Piñera, called a national referendum on whether there should be a new constitution. The underlying concern is that economic and political inequality remains a significant problem in Chile. And this may only be addressed if there's significant political and constitutional change. Now, the referendum on the new constitution was scheduled for April, but in light of COVID-19 has predictably been postponed, and it's currently scheduled to take place on October 25. Now, the general impression seems to be that while it's still too early to call, there's very strong support for a new constitution. To be clear, no finalized text of new constitution is on the ballot for October. But if the referendum yields then a vote in favor of a new constitution, then a constitutional assembly would be called for, and a protracted period of legal uncertainty in the country would likely follow. So it would probably take a couple of years at least for the new constitution to be drafted, voted, and come into force. If earlier demands from social agents are any guidance, the new constitution can be expected to limit somewhat property rights and the use of and access to natural resources by private corporations. And there have also been voices arguing that the new constitution should also limit the use of investment arbitration against the state. Of course, to this political process and uncertainty, you must add the measures recently taken by the government to address COVID-19. Some of which have been remarkably more invasive than those of neighboring countries. For instance, in Chile, companies are now allowed to suspend payroll and payment to employees and have a state-run fund their employees because of the COVID-19 created crisis. But interestingly, Chilean Sociedades Anónimas, kind of LTDs, seeking this type of benefit must waive the distribution of dividends for as long as the company receives the benefit, the payroll protection from the government. So in the wake of this measure, you can safely predict both investment disputes and commercial disputes, specifically shareholders disagreeing over whether or not a company should forgo distributing dividends in exchange for having the government pay for its employees. Also, since late last year, the government has frozen electricity tariffs. And now, in light of COVID-19, there are talks that end users may be exempted from paying tariffs for a good while, for as long as the crisis lasts. The burden this is obviously placing on power generation and distribution companies is significant. And if the measure is eventually adopted, claims are likely to be expected. Investment claims against the government are to be expected for sure. So Rekha, that's Chile, political and investment overview in a quick nutshell. Back to you.
Thank you so much. And so now we go again to Noyana to tell us about the landscape of investment arbitration in land.
Yeah, I want to just touch base and give one or two more elements to the analysis that Aníbal brought to the table regarding investment arbitration, which I completely agree that we will see probably more claims against Chile. And Chile has been so far a country that had been relatively sued very little in Latin America when we take into account the amount of foreign investment that Chile has attracted in the last probably three decades, and only had four arbitration or four investment arbitration in history is very significant. But we will probably see a change on that, as Aníbal was saying. One interesting element is, of course, as a reaction to this social unrest, we had the tariff decreases or even the freezing of tariffs that Aníbal mentioned, and we are seeing already some activity in Congress. So there have been already some bills that were presented by congressmen trying to introduce a change to the Chilean system of running many of the services with private investors. And one of the last bills proposed a complete nationalization of the pension fund system. And what was interesting is that it was introduced with no compensation, so it will be nationalization without compensation, which probably will, if it happens and if it's approved in the future, that might lead certainly to some investment arbitrations, as we've seen in other countries, like in Bolivia in the moment, and some claims against Argentina for that matter. Moving to commercial arbitration, a little bit in the same way as Peru and Lima was working very hard to get their seat as up in the list for the accepted seat for arbitrations in Latin America, Chile has also done a huge amount of work trying to educate their courts, trying to promote Santiago as a seat of arbitration. Of course, the stability of the country made Chile probably a very good candidate for that. Maybe a little bit far away in the region to get there. But the reality is that the improvement has been slowed in terms of the number of international cases that they have had. They had an initial success with Ecuador. Ecuador had accepted to have Santiago as a seat of arbitration in many of the state contracts with foreign investors. When the foreign investors require a neutral seat for arbitration, Chile became much more acceptable for Ecuador than any of the other seats that were proposed by the investors. And the reality is, when you look at the practice, the decisions of the court so far have been very good in terms of time to get a decision on annulment. And even the cost of annulments is very, very low compared to other jurisdictions. So it has all of the elements to become a really good option in Latin America. And the institutions that we see there, we have the CAM, this Arbitration and Mediation Center of the Santiago Chambers of Commerce, is very, very active, and it has been trying to be ahead in terms of the systems. And probably it's worth noting that the CAM was a pioneer in putting all of its docket in virtually. So they have been running a lot of arbitrations already online for many, many years. So they were really well prepared for this pandemic. And I think we will see in the future, I think regardless of what is going on on the side of investment arbitrations, and hopefully we don't see a backlash towards commercial arbitration, which happened in Argentina, given all of the cases that Argentina had before ICSID and under investment treaties, the local community also, in a way, rejected many of the principles of the domestic or the commercial arbitration. So hopefully it doesn't happen in Chile, because it really has a lot of elements that put Chile as a very good option for a seat. And as Aníbal was saying, we can see now after COVID-19 probably an increase in commercial disputes in the country that probably will lead to more cases sitting in Chile, which will create much more jurisprudence. That is what we need as counsel when we try to advise our clients, is what if we want to find a seat in Latin America, how do we choose? Okay, first of all, we look at whether there is a modern law. Chile has a modern law. And then the second thing you look at is there enough evidence that the court are respectful of the arbitration proceedings, yes or no? And the problem with Chile so far is that the history was not, that there were not abundant jurisprudence to have really a very solid answer to that question. But my guess is that in the future, in the next couple of years, particularly with the disputes that we're going to see because of COVID, we will have a much robust jurisprudence that hopefully will put Santiago as first in the line for Latin America as a seat of arbitration.
Thanks so much, Noyana. As both Aníbal and Noyana have shared, Chile has generally been a stable environment until recent times. Stay tuned, constitutional reform may well be on the horizon, and perhaps we can learn something from Chile on virtual proceedings as we all learn to adapt. In the context of investment law and reform, Chile has put forward a submission with Israel and Japan to the UNCTAD 12 Working Group 3, and so I encourage you also to check that out as we continue the dialogue. I want to now share something very important, the CLE code, for those of you that need credit. The CLE code is 3594. Again, the CLE code is 3594. With that, as I recognize that we are almost against the time slot, I'd like to invite either Aníbal or Noyana to just weigh in. We're trying to create a sort of methodical look at Latin America. We started out with change within the system. Now we're at change to the system. And so what are the distinctions as we move from the first podcast to this, the second podcast? Aníbal, Noyana, I'm curious to hear any of your thoughts.
I'll be happy to start. I think it's an interesting transition, the one we're having from podcast one to podcast two. When we had the first podcast, we were basically talking about countries that, while they were undergoing significant legal and political change, that change was still taking place without affecting the fundamentals of the nation, the constitution, the judiciary. So in a way, it is a more contained type of change. And as you might recall, we were talking about Mexico Ecuador and Argentina at the time. So it's a fluid situation, but it's somewhat predictable, at least unless something new and significant happens. The countries we're discussing today are in a much more aggressive path of change. I mean, these are countries where either you have an outright constitutional crisis, as is the case with Bolivia and with Chile, or you might have one looming in the not too distant horizon, as is the situation with Peru. And in fact, in Peru, you have other problems beyond just constitutional reform. So I guess the situation in Peru and Bolivia and Chile is much more uncertain than it is in the other three countries that we analyzed in podcast one. This is quite significant, I think, for arbitration practices, because interestingly, of the six countries that we've discussed to date, the two that had the most well-established and the most successful arbitration centers were Lima and Santiago de Chile. They were magnets of local and regional international arbitration, and they were starting to succeed in becoming magnets for global international disputes. Will that continue to be the case now that, in a way, many things are up for grabs? It's very unclear. I think Noyana put it very well. Lima is going to need years to recover, I think, for its recent decisions arresting arbitrators and really putting, I believe, an unfairly aggressive magnifying glass over arbitrations. So I think yes, I mean, things are changing with when you add COVID-19 to the mix and everything is in flux. But I think the effect that change is having on the three countries that we discussed today is way more significant and way more likely to affect our practices as arbitration lawyers than the change that we saw in the countries that we discussed 2 or 3 weeks ago, Ecuador, Mexico, and Argentina.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the parallels that we could do, and actually looking at all of the countries and what is going on, I think we see the constant pendulum that we've seen all throughout Latin American history. And actually that pendulum that doesn't allow the region and the populations to really move forward. When we looked at Argentina, Mexico, and Ecuador, although it's within the same constitutional structure, to call it in that way, we're seeing a huge change in political winds and also in economic policies. So somehow we're going back 10 years and we started all over again. We don't know exactly where that's going to end. When we look at the countries that we have today, huge crisis, where the countries that were more stable, at least for the last two decades, including Bolivia, because they've been very stable economically and politically, and somehow it didn't last. And we see, for completely different reasons, again, a new structure that is basically claimed by the populations and create a new system. We are in complete uncertainty in this with respect to what is going to happen in these three countries, because we are still in the middle of those movements. We have now the constitutional reform in Chile, Bolivia, where I have to wait until we see what the new permanent government is going to be like, and the same thing for Peru. What is something that covers all of the countries of today, that many of these changes come from a rejection of corruption and corruption in different ways. So we can see Peru, clearly corruption, Odebrecht, clear bribes. But also we've seen a concept of corruption in the protest in Chile and Bolivia. And the corruption there was a government or governments that, in the case of Bolivia, was able to remain in place for much longer than really what the constitution allowed, and hasn't created a constitutional way to, even in, within the same party, have a successor. And when we look at Chile, the corruption of the system. It's a system that, although economically was doing super well and was creating fantastic results, those results were not permeating into the society, and there was a small group of people that kept getting the benefits. And that was seen as corruption, in the sense that there was no equality in how the society was being treated, or the different levels in society. So it's a very interesting time. And certainly many of these movements will bring more balanced systems, which at least I want to remain positive. So at least in the countries that we looked at today, hopefully in a year or 2 years time, we're going to be having a discussion that shows that some things move forward.
I think you're making a very perceptive point, Noyana. Unlike other big changes in Latin America, which were sometimes dictated by sheer ideology or political desire to grab power, I think the changes we're discussing today have a very strong rule of law underlying component. There are many, many excesses, I think, particularly in the case of Peru, those are remarkable in how that will to apply the rule of law is taken to practice. But I think the underlying initial impetus behind the reform is praiseworthy, and even though it will take time to find what the new normal is, it should build on some existing premises, separation of power, if not market economy, at least an economy that's based on market principles, but also tries to be fair to everyone. So I think you might be in for a protracted process, which, even though it causes initial uncertainty, lays out a future basis for lasting stability and prosperity.
Well, there you have it. Winds of change. We are moving, as you all know, on July 11th to assessing Venezuela and Brazil. And we hope that you will be tuning in then. I'm going to repeat the CLE code one more time if you didn't catch it. The CLE code is 3594. Again, that's 3594. I thank Noyana and Anibal and all of you for tuning in today. It's really been a pleasure. We hope to see you, or speak to you rather, on June 11th. And we wish you continued good health and safety in these times. As always, please note, we're in this together. Thanks so much, everyone, and we'll talk to you again on June 11th.
Thank you. Thank you, Rekha. Thank you, Noyana.
Thank you. Stay safe.